Thank you very much. I'm going to click show my screen, and I assume everybody can see my... Can you hear me now? Okay, hi, welcome. Thank you very much for joining. And I hope you can see the slides. It says how hospital pharmacies can win the war between talent. We'll be making a presentation, and during the presentation, I hope you, if you have questions, concerns, comments, reactions, I hope you write them down so that we can discuss them in more detail. There's going to be two parts to this, and I'm going to go to the first one. We're going to be summarizing the 2009 National Pharmacy Workforce Study, which appeared in this month. I'm going to summarize it, then I'll give you my reactions to it, and I'd love to get your reactions to it. The next part is we're going to be discussing what I see as both a war for talent and a war between talent that's going to affect hospital pharmacy managers. And specifically, I want to talk about how hospital-based pharmacies can win this new war that I see coming up. So that's the agenda for the hour. Thanks to Megan, we have a link that is on these slides that gives you a summary of a 2009 National Pharmacy Workforce Study. And we're going to be talking about it in more detail. Last week I was at a coffee shop and there was a little sign which I thought was apropos for this topic, which is life isn't about waiting for the storm to pass, it's about learning to dance in the rain. Many of the trends that I'm going to be discussing are long-term trends that affect staffing in pharmacies. And so the issue is dealing with these long-term trends, which probably will continue for as long as most of you are going to be working. The reason I put that quote down is that in some of the meetings that I have with healthcare professionals, I see a lot of people, particularly boomers, spending a lot of time grousing about how good things used to be and how they don't like the way things are. And then I say, life isn't about waiting for the storm to pass. This is about learning how to dance in the rain. The final report of the 2009 National Sample Survey was released in March 2010. Again, thanks for Heather for bringing this to my attention. And you can see the full, you can get the full link to the report on the link that is on your screen right now. I'm going to summarize the report. There were almost 3,000 pharmacists that were surveyed, and there was a 52% response rate. That's pretty good for surveys. As you look between 2000 and 2009, the proportion of pharmacists working full-time has been decreasing. You can see the numbers in front of you. So it's a pretty steady decrease. And the number of part-time pharmacists has been increasing. So we're seeing a long-term trend, and I think no matter what form of healthcare is passed or not passed, I don't see any changes in that trend. So that the percentage of workers who are going to be working part-time will be increasing. Not only will they be part-timers, but they will increasingly be an older generation. Again, the results indicate an aging population. In 2009, there were 37% over the age of 55 compared to 31% in 2004 and 21% or 22% in 2000. That's pretty dramatic about the aging of the population of people who work in pharmacies. Again, we're talking about hospital-based and non-hospital-based pharmacies. Another consistent trend from the year 2000 onwards is the lack of racial diversity in the pharmacy working population. There are only 1.7% Hispanics. That's significantly less than the U.S. population as a whole. 0.4% are American Indians. Age and gender. The percentage of actively practicing females has been increasing, and you can see it's a pretty dramatic, from 45% in 2000 to 46% in 2009. I think that's going to only increase over time. Again, we on the age side, we see that in 2000, 44% of practicing pharmacists were 40 and younger, but it keeps decreasing. At the same time, the percentage of pharmacists over the age of 55 keeps increasing. I don't see any change in that trend. What is interesting is that males are significantly more negatively affected by some of the changes in the workforce than females. Females seem to be better able to adapt to some of the new trends that are going on in pharmacy. Males are more likely to be complaining about how great things used to be compared to how things are today. In every practice setting, whether it's hospital or non-hospital practice, pharmacists would love to spend less time dispensing medication. If you look at the ways in which pharmacists spend their time, they could be dispensing medication, business and organization management, patient care, education, and research activities. Everybody would like to spend less time dispensing medication. They'd like to spend less time on organization management, and they want to spend more time with patient care services, education, and research. The interesting thing is that 70% of non-hospital-based pharmacy employees spend their time doing what they don't want to do, which is dispensing medication. And only 10% of their time is spent on patient care services. Now, when you go to pharmacists who work in hospitals, it's a much more positive picture. People who work in hospitals devote 43% of their time to dispensing medications only, and 27% of their time to patient care services. So here's my reaction to this report. One reaction to the report is focus on passion and payment for the younger people. By passion, what I mean is you have an opportunity to recruit pharmacists saying, we in hospital-based pharmacies, you're more likely to do the kinds of things that you went into pharmacy to be able to do than if you worked in any other kind of setting. So that appeals to the passion. The other issue deals with payment, and I'm going to get to that in the next slide. When we're looking at older workers, particularly women, focus on flexibility. They very much value flexibility. And you want to hire people who are flexible. You want to hire people who know how to dance in the rain rather than complaining about how great things were when it used to be sunny. Passion is the hospital-based edge in recruitment. You have a higher probability of doing what you really want to pharmacy school to do. We're going to be talking about this later on when we talk about younger people. But again, this is, I think, the hospital-based edge in recruitment. The other issue that I think is important is the issue about loans. The report said that when pharmacy students come out of pharmacy school, they have about $125,000 on average in loans. Indeed, I was talking with the dean of a pharmacy school yesterday, and he said that most pharmacy students, when they graduate, they don't rent apartments. They go back and they live home with their parents so they can pay down the student loan. And they feel their life only really commences once they pay down their loan, and then they can start affording their own homes and being their own people. So paying down that loan is a non-trivial issue and can be used by hospitals in attracting younger pharmacists. Again, with the demographic shifts that are going on in the pharmacy profession to older population, those that can attract and retain younger pharmacists will certainly have an edge. And it's going to be critical in terms of succession planning. One of the thoughts that I had, and it's just a thought, is for many hospitals there are freezes in salaries, and that's a difficult part of the budget to move. I was thinking a non-salary piece of compensation would be assistance in loan repayment. Now, I made the $2,000 simply just as a number for discussion purposes. But if a hospital was to pay $2,000 a year, not in salary, but in loan repayment directly to the lending institution that lend the student the money, that $2,000 is less expensive than the same $2,000 in added salary. The reason why it's less expensive is that money that goes out in salary also has other triggers associated with it. For example, you raise somebody's salary by $2,000, that also raises their premium on life insurance. It also raises the premium on disability insurance. Whereas if the money simply goes out in the form of a payment on a loan that is due for college, then that is simply the money that, and it doesn't trigger anything beyond that. So that's why I say the same amount in loan repayment is less expensive to a hospital than increasing a salary. I also think that young people these days think in terms of short-term horizons, and a $500 loan repayment every 90 days might be a more attractive retention tool than once a year $2,000. It's the same cost to the hospital, but it's spread out differently. And again, the reason I say that is because if somebody has to wait a year before they're going to get $2,000, they might just say, it's not worth it. On the other hand, if somebody has an offer someplace else and they say, well, if I take it now, I forego $500 in loan payment, they may think about it a little more differently. Again, it's the idea about a shorter time span focus. I said in the last bullet that hospital payouts directly to lending institutions on behalf of the employee may be a non-taxable event to the employee, since the employee doesn't have control over the money and is sent directly to the lending institution. I really want to emphasize that I'm not a tax professional, and I may be wrong about that. The model for what I am suggesting is based on what the government has been doing with doctors in helping to repay their loan in return for service, and I believe some hospitals are doing with nurses. The reason why I suggest that some sort of loan repayment be chopped up into quarterly segments rather than annualized segments has to do with the way people think. And that is, the perceived pain of loss is more acute than the sweetness of potential gain. In other words, the risk factor of actually losing money for sure in 30 days, 60 days, 90 days is more acute and people are more sensitive to it than the potential sweetness of getting $2,000 a year from now. Again, U.S. Army does it for physicians. Some hospitals do it for nurses. I'm simply suggesting this is a relatively lower cost way of helping to attract and retain younger pharmacists. And if I'm correct, there are certain ethnic groups that are underrepresented, particularly in American Indian populations and Hispanic populations. Now, this slide talks about, again, focusing on the two issues for younger people. If you work for a hospital, you have a higher potential to do what you actually went into pharmacy school to do. And we're going to help you pay down your college debt. And again, for many pharmacy graduates, life doesn't begin until the debt is filled. So the faster they can fill that debt, the faster they can move out of the house and begin their lives. Again, think about any questions or comments that you might have that we can discuss. I want to now talk about the title of this talk, which is The Coming War Between Talent. The Coming War Between Talent. First, I want to give a little background. I'll first talk about the War for Talent, which started in 1998, to where I think things are going to be going, which is a two-front war, which is a war for talent and a war between talent. And guess what? The pharmacy manager is in the middle of this two-front war. So what else is new? I will suggest that hospital pharmacy managers focus on the war between talent and let the war for talent take care of itself. So that's the summary of what we are talking about. The war for talent began in 1988 with an article that appeared in the McKinsey Journal. It was published by two consultants from McKinsey and Company, and they talked about the coming war for talent. What they were saying was that in the companies that are McKinsey clients, we're seeing the following trend. There's a shortage of good people, good young people available, and there is this tremendous turnover as boomers retire. And there just is going to be a shortage of talent. The concept, the title, The Coming War for Talent, became a rallying cry. And many people in human resources used that article as a framing mechanism to justify training, management development, better hiring procedures. And by the way, most of the companies benefited from having those things, and they were well needed. Was there really a war for talent? I would argue, yeah, there was. Talent, particularly in the pharmacy area, is always in short supply. There is a war for talent. There was in 1989, and there is today, and there will be in the future. But the idea of boomers retiring, that's not going to happen. And I think we all know why it's not going to happen. One is people are living longer. Two, there's a greater fear of outliving one's assets. And so three, the retirement models of that when you're 62 to 65, you move to Florida and play golf for the rest of your life is just not going to happen. What we're seeing, as that study indicates, is that more and more people are opting to work on a part-time basis. If they want more flexibility in their lives, but they're going to be continuing to work. So the war for talent proposed there's going to be this sucking void and nobody to fill it. My framework is there still is a war for good talent, but it's not that there's a void. There's going to be more a conflict between employees in the organization. And there's going to be four fronts in this war between talent. First is between full-time and part-timers. The second is between boomers and millennials. The third is between robots and humans. And the fourth is between outsourced versus in-house services. I'm going to talk about each of those fronts, give some examples, and I'd appreciate what you think about them. The first is full-time versus part-time. Again, we saw in the pharmacy study that more and more pharmacy people will be working on a less than full-time basis. My colleague at Suffolk University, Sheila Weber, has done a study on employees with multiple identities versus singular identities when they are working on an interim or part-time basis at client companies. Now, what does that mean? It means people who are comfortable assuming multiple identities. For example, again, I hate to go back to the stereotypic of women, but women are forced to assume multiple identities of mother, worker, wife. They're comfortable wearing many different hats. A lot of us guys who are trained in really traditional ways, we tend to wear one hat at a time. And we wear that one hat very well. But we weren't necessarily trained to have multiple identities at the same time. And so people who have difficulty with multiple identities tend to have difficulty in part-time roles. And the reason they have these kinds of difficulties is when they come in on a part-time basis, they don't necessarily integrate themselves into the team or feel themselves part of a team. They feel themselves like a substitute teacher coming to teach for on a Tuesday and Thursday, but they don't feel part of the fabric. Whereas people who are comfortable with multiple identities and have been doing that for a number of years, they're very comfortable saying, on Tuesday, Thursday, I'm a member of this team, and this is part of me. The question I have for when you're interviewing people for part-time jobs is to see about their flexibility in taking on multiple roles. And again, the question that I have is, give me the name of a reference will tell me about your ability to juggle multiple roles. What would that person say? I would then be inclined to check references on that. How good are they in dealing with conflicting and multiple roles? In some organization, part-timers and interims really feel part of the fabric of the organization. They're invited to Christmas parties. If there's a bonus, they may share in the bonus. Their names are listed in the directory. In other organizations that I've observed, the part-timers or the interim people that are coming in, really, they're made to feel like they're outsiders. Of course, when you are being served, you don't know those fine distinctions between part-time and full-time. All you know is that some people are providing you with better service than others. A classic example in hospital is the hospital nurse. When I'm a patient in a hospital, a nurse is a nurse. I don't ask if the nurse is full-time in the organization, part-time, or interim. I know good nursing when I see it. I know bad nursing when I see it. And it doesn't matter to me what the status of the person is. It reflects poorly on the institution, no matter what that person is, part-time or full-time. So do your part-timers really feel part of the team? Are there parties? Are they invited? Again, the implication from the study that we talked about earlier is that this issue about part-time versus full-time is only going to increase. The next source of stress is going to be boomers versus millennials. We're going to have this issue where a greater and greater percentage of the population will be boomers. But the real precious resource for the future are going to be the millennials. It's the millennials who are going to be taking over. It's the millennials that will be the leader, the next leaders. So are there enough of them? So it's not going to be kind of an issue that a worker is a worker. Actually, the younger workers are going to be more valued than the older workers. There's a study that was done March 3rd in Career Builders. 76% of women over the age of 60 are putting off retirement versus 68% of men. Why? Because women are living longer. Why? Because women make less money than men as a general rule, and so they are more likely to be concerned about outliving their wealth. The generational conflicts, I suspect that many of your pharmacy organizations are already beginning to experience that. Younger people are not only younger, but they think differently. They went through different experiences than boomers. And as a result, there's a different thought process. One conflict is going to be between an older worker who is reporting to a younger boss. And the older worker may not respect the younger person, may not respect the way that person is thinking, may not respect the person's work values, and doesn't disguise that lack of respect. That's a problem. Another problem is with older bosses who are managing younger and impatient workers who don't really appreciate the way the older person is thinking and don't manage to camouflage their lack of respect. Again, these are going to be two flashpoints that I see in hospital pharmacies. One way of sort of thinking about the difference between the generations is, I think, the difference between Superman versus Harry Potter. I'm 62 years old. I grew up on Superman and Batman. And for me and a lot of people my age, the lone hero, the Rambo, is the quintessential hero. Somebody who is relevant, powerful, and alone. That's the hero of my generation. But the hero of this generation coming up is Harry Potter. And Harry Potter can't exist alone. Harry Potter needs his essentially not his real family, because his real family is dysfunctional, but his extended family, his posse. He can't function without that posse. And many of the kids that I'm seeing who are millennials are like that. They like to work in groups. They don't necessarily want to stick out. Assignments that I used to give as individual assignments, I now give as group assignments. And instead of calling on Joe to tell me what Joe thinks, I may call on Joe to be the representative of the group to tell me what the group thinks. Again, I'm not taking a value judgment on what's good or bad. I'm just saying this is the way people are thinking these days. Another big difference between the way people are thinking is what I call the rise of the secular spiritualists. Actually, this is not me who's saying this. It's a man named Zugby, Zoogby. And he wrote a book called The Zugby Report. Zugby does research for NBC and Microsoft. And he was surveying some of the differences in values between the millennials and Generation Xers and the boomers. And he came up with a term that I'd never heard before, but does fit, and that's called the secular spiritualists versus personal relevance. The boomers were raised on the issue about being relevant and being personally effective. That's important. The millennials are more raised on in terms of being part of a group, being part of a team. That's why social networking is so important for this group. And social networking and using things like Facebook and Twitter are just so absurd for the boomers. The other thing that is occurring with the millennials is the idea of secular spiritualism. In other words, they look at the boomer generation and they feel that they are a failure. They didn't provide leadership. They didn't make the planet any better. They were greedy. They were selfish. They were too much into themselves. And so the secular spiritualists, which are coming up, they want their organizations to stand for something. You're beginning to see companies get the picture. For example, there is a company called Dove, which makes a beauty bar soap. And they've come out with a commercial aimed at young girls, showing them that a lot of the concepts of beauty that they see on television and magazines are basically created in Photoshop. They show commercials of average-looking kids who are dressed up in Photoshop to become stunning, perfect women. That's an example of secular spiritualism. we're in the beauty business, but we're showing young women, don't get caught up in beauty. A lot of it is fabricated. That would never have happened in my generation. Another example, Pepsi-Cola. Pepsi-Cola sponsors exercise, lifestyle, fitness. In other words, we stand for healthy foods, even though we sell carbonated soda. Again, that seems paradoxical, but Pepsi wants to stand for something that's more important. Again, hospital-based pharmacies can appeal to the younger generation by saying, we represent your ability to do more of what you went into pharmacy school to do than if you went into any other kind of pharmacy. That's going to become increasingly more important to these secular spiritualists. And again, it's a very different mindset than boomers. Boomers are more inclined to say, what's in it for me? How is this relevant for me? That's not how secular spiritualists think. Obviously, there are major differences in communication modalities between generations. The younger generation communicates in ways that we boomers just do not understand. And just because we don't understand it doesn't mean we can't respect it. So, for example, boomers are much more likely to communicate by email, whereas, millennials are more likely to communicate electronically. Messages that could have been communicated on the phone or face-to-face. We boomers don't understand that, but that is kind of how they communicate. One thing I found astounding is that more people are on Facebook than are on Google. And more messages are being communicated on Facebook than on email. Again, differences in communication modalities. I, as a boomer, I recognize the differences. I'm trying to understand this younger generation. I'm on Facebook. I'm on Twitter. I don't understand it, but I'm on it, and I'm trying to communicate in different modalities. Again, secular spiritualism implies people want to feel that they are part of a team that's doing something important. So, for example, you can motivate younger people by having thank you dinners where maybe guest speakers, could be a patient, could be a doctor, might say, you team are important to our hospital, and here's an example of some things that you have done. For example, there is a company makes medical devices. They'll have an annual meeting for employees where they'll bring in a patient whose life was saved using the medical device. The patient will simply come and thank them as a collective for saving his or her life. For boomers, they may react in a cynical way that, what does this mean? But millennials really want to hear that. The next conflict that I see is an emerging conflict between humans and robots. It is clear, regardless of what kind of health bill passes, that in order to cut costs, robots are going to have to do more of the heavy lifting. Clearly, in the case of nurses, it's robots that are going to be physically moving patients around or turning patients around. It's just a matter of time before that happens. The technology is already there. I know that there are robots that are used in pharmaceutical research labs and chemical research labs to actually make formula and do some of the more sort of mundane processing. Just like the automobile industry was transformed by robots, I see a lot, the pharmacy industry will also be transformed by robots. It will actually do a lot of the counting of the pills and that currently humans do. This is going to create a problem. There are certain religious traditions where that's okay. you know, you work beside the robot, it's cool. In a Christian Judeo tradition, God created the heaven and earth, and then he created humans to be the Lord over the what he created on earth. There's a clear hierarchy that doesn't necessarily exist in other traditions. In a hierarchy where God created humans to lord over the earth, what are you doing when a robot is essentially next to you and your effectiveness depends on the robot? I had something happen to me last year that relates to something that's been done by Professor Cynthia Brazil of MIT Intelligence Lab. I have one of these mapping devices. It's a navigation tool that many people have in their cars. And it tells you where you should be going, and it tells you how to get there. That's easy. But I found it. I was bothered by this female voice telling me what to do. And I'm thinking, okay, I'm a typical male and I'm having a problem having yet another woman tell me what to do. So I change the voice on the system from female to male, and I make it a British male voice. And then I create a sort of a backstory for this British male voice. I call him Lord Geoffrey. And I have this story where Geoffrey is actually an idiot savant, where he is brilliant at directions, but he can't do anything else, and I need to take care of him because he's so stupid. That has led me to be more comfortable taking directions from Geoffrey, this fantasy about this idiot savant. I thought this was my sexism and my craziness, until I read a study by Cynthia Brazil of MIT Intelligence Labs. She found that the most effective way to get human robots to work with each other is to have the humans, quote-unquote, take care of the robots so that they are in a nurturing role with the robots as opposed to taking orders from the robots. And suddenly, my little, the thing I was doing with Lord Geoffrey in my car did make some sense. I was taking care of Lord Geoffrey, and Lord Geoffrey was taking care of me. Again, the last source of conflict that I see is something that I don't think pharmacies are seeing now, but I think they will see more of, and that's what is done within the borders of the United States versus those things that are done outside the borders of the United States telephonically. For example, I live in Boston, and Mass General Hospital has a very profitable service where radiologists are contracted out to hospitals around the world and in rural communities to read x-rays. So that's an example where instead of relying on local talent, you can use the existing telecommunications technology to have a radiologist look at x-rays and give an opinion. Today, my accountant sends out tax work to China for the actual calculation and bookkeeping. There's a service that McDonald's uses. When you drive up to the McDonald's window and you give your order, it is not necessarily the case that that order is being taken by somebody at the store. There's a firm in Colorado that actually can take the order, process the order, give it back to the store people that are actually in the kitchen, and make it more effective. In other words, a lot of what we used to call outsourcing is not just manual labor, but some intellectual work is going to be outsourced. Again, given the cost structure, will there be more outsourcing outside the United States through telecommunications? I predict that there will be. again, what are the implications about that? I suspect there will be, but I'm not quite sure how they will work. Certainly, in the short term, the outsourcing of work outside the United States can have positive implications in heavily unionized environments, since union people don't like that, and there are certain communities that are more heavily unionized than other communities. So, I'm going to summarize what we're talking about, then I want to leave some time available for your comments, reactions, and suggestions. What I'm saying is that there is going to be two wars, not one war. One war is going to be called the war for talent, and the other one is going to be called the war between talent. Two wars, not one war. Your mission as a pharmacy manager is going to be looking to smooth some of the conflicts between generations, that understanding that different is different, not better or worse. There are going to be differences in the way people communicate with each other. There are going to be differences in the way that people respond to technology. There's going to be differences between the way in which people accept responsibility as individuals or want to accept responsibility as part of groups. There's going to be differences in the way in which people want to be personally relevant versus socially relevant. Making project or interim or part-time people being part of the team is going to be very important. Because when a doctor has a problem, the doctor doesn't ask, are you full-time or part-time? The doctor says, I'm having a problem with this person. In hiring people, you want to hire people with track records for juggling multiple roles. And you want to ask questions about references, about their ability to have more than one hat. Flexibility is going to be really important. You want people who say, okay, I'm going to learn how to dance in the rain rather than how to complain about how it used to be when it was sunny. Secular spiritualism is going to be an increasingly important issue with young people. Why are we here? What are we doing that's of value? Again, for the young, it's about the team rather than the individual. And again, that might have implications in terms of how we design compensation systems in pharmacies. And again, I think the high cost of educational loan repayment is an opportunity that hospitals could capitalize on. Grooming the next generation of pharmacy leaders is going to be difficult. One, finding them, retaining them, growing them, and attracting them is going to be difficult, particularly minorities. Again, life isn't about waiting for the storm to pass, it's about learning to dance in the rain. So this concludes the formal presentation. And right now what I'd like to do is to shut up and see if there are any comments that you all have.